Okay, so it's a big picture talk, and I hope that I don't get anything largely inaccurate. I know I'm going to get a lot of things imprecise, right? Meaning I'm going to be skipping over a lot of distinctions that probably in the end ought to be made. But I hope that overall the story that I'm telling is roughly accurate. So it's a big picture kind of talk, and hopefully I'll be fair, and if I'm not fair, you'll catch me on it, right, and correct me. I should also say something about why I'm talking about ancient religion and modern science. I mean, I'm certainly not talking about the ancient religions that nobody believes anymore. I'm not really interested in those. But it seems to me that there's a kind of continuity in religion that you might not find exactly in science, meaning many religious people today believe the kind of stuff that were believed in ancient times. If you take Christianity, such as at some point Christians believed in the resurrection of Jesus, right? That belief hasn't substantially changed for most Christians over most of history, right? It's not like Democritus's view of the atom, where you can't say that the scientists today still believe in the Democritean atom. You might find a similar word, but the belief isn't similar at all. So it seems to me that there's been substantive change in science, whereas there hasn't been that kind of substantive change in religion. There have been changes, and perhaps very significant changes, but not of the core issues. And hopefully that'll become clearer as I proceed. Here's my basic argument that I want to try to present. It seems to me that most ancient religions have at their core doctrines about creation and the soul and providence. And again, this is a very broad brush, so depending on the religion you have in mind, there might be different emphases, different detailed beliefs about each of these things. But what do I mean? Something about creation, where the world came from, how it came into being, or if it came into being, but what kind of grounds the existence of the world. The soul, almost all religions have something to say about some kind of afterlife, whether it's an immaterial soul going on to an afterlife or some kind of resurrection story where there's some continued existence after the normal kind of death of the person. And providence, which is a catch-all term about God or some kind of divine force or divine entity, being concerned for us, that we are here for some sort of purpose. There's some sort of religious agenda being worked out. And that can give us hope, right? Because there's a guarantee that things will work out. It could also, of course, inspire fear, depending on exactly how things are supposed to be working out. Okay. So most ancient religions have at their core these sorts of doctrines. But I would say scientific naturalism, which we'll talk about at some length, does not allow for any of these things. Core doctrines about creation, soul, and providence. And so therefore, if we accept naturalism, something about religion has got to change. Religion has these issues at their core. Scientific naturalism says, can't have them. And so if we accept naturalism, something has got to change. Now, many people might say, so much the worse for naturalism. If becoming a scientific naturalist means giving up on heaven and the soul and providence, well, then so much the worse for scientific naturalism. Why not just reject that? And certainly there is a large tradition that would deny science or deny scientific naturalism or at least deny its final authority. Maybe people would say science is good as a kind of approximation, or perhaps they would say science is a kind of illusion, right? Or it describes the illusion that we experience while encased in our bodies. But fundamentally, it doesn't get at the real truth of things. So this could be called a radical fideism, or radical faithism, fides is faith, which denies the legitimacy of natural knowledge. And there's a couple of biblical quotes that you might, from the New Testament, that you might pull out to support this view. First from 1 Corinthians, but God hath chosen the foolish things of the world to confound the wise, right? So you have all of these wise people who think that they know what they're talking about, and there are all of these foolish ideas lying about. God has taken those foolish ideas and will use them to confound the wise. The stuff that the wise think is foolish turns out to actually be the truth. Or again, from 1 Corinthians. 1 Corinthians is really loaded with this. It's almost as if Paul had, you know, some real problems with the church at Corinth that were maybe being too prideful in their reason or something. But the second passage is, for the wisdom of this world is foolishness with God. For it is written, he taketh the wise in their own craftiness. Right? So the wisdom of this world is but foolishness to God. You certainly get this kind of view from thinkers like Pascal and Kierkegaard, that reason or scientific knowledge really isn't worth anything when it comes to the ultimate matters. But I'm going to have nothing to say about this, right? It seems to me that if that's the route that somebody takes, if they want to be a radical fideist and deny the legitimacy of scientific knowledge, off you go, have a nice time, right? I really don't have any deep answer to that. So let's set that view aside or try to. But somebody might have a tamer kind of reservation about the power of science. Might not say, look, it's completely... They may not want to say it's completely illegitimate. They don't want to say that. But they might say, but certainly science can't pretend to have the final answer. So what about doubting science? What about saying, well, maybe science doesn't have a complete picture of things? And there's certainly good reason for doubting the authority of science. I think the best view of science that philosophers of science have been able to come up with is something that comes from Karl Popper, which amounts to a kind of skepticism or fallibilism, this view that scientists never actually prove a theory. You can't ever really prove a theory. The most that you can do is try to falsify the theory and fail. Right? So somebody comes up with a theory, it sounds good, it looks good, seems reasonable. You try and you try and you try to falsify it. And if you fail, really all that you can do is say, well, so far so good. Right? I don't have any conclusive reason for thinking that it's false. But how do I know that the next decisive experiment isn't just around the corner and it's going to be performed and then we'll have to scramble to pick up a new theory? Scientific revolutions are always possible. And one is always reminded of this story that apparently some physics professor at Harvard told all of his students, don't go into physics, find something else to do, because in physics we've figured it all out. The rest is sort of mop-up work. We have nothing more to discover. And this was roughly a decade before Einstein published his three very revolutionary papers in physics, right? So this was the end of the 19th century. So, you know, it was far from true that physics had everything figured out. There was the, of course, Einsteinian revolution and then the quantum mechanics revolution and maybe some more beyond that. So anybody has to admit, even the most ardent proponent of science, has to admit that scientific revolutions are always possible. But the critical question is whether we have any reason now for thinking that our scientific theories are wrong or fundamentally incomplete, right? There might be times when you say the theory predicts X and yet we do these experiments and X never happens. That never comes about. That might be a reason for thinking that the theory is wrong. Or you might have reason for thinking that the scientific theories are fundamentally incomplete. There's something that just can't get explained by science the way that it is. So if you had these sorts of reasons, you'd have good reason for doubting the legitimacy of modern science. But do we have any such reason now? And I say, no. And here it'd be really nice for me to be able to prove that, but I won't. And I know that Richard in the back is thinking of attempts to explain the origins of life through a kind of scientific naturalistic way. And Richard, right, you would say, no, that kind of way of looking at life is fundamentally incomplete, right?
Well, no, or at least... we have no models that will do that.
Okay, right. So far, I mean, we do have some, Richard would say, we do have some reason now for thinking our scientific theories are fundamentally incomplete. But there's something else that has to be factored in. And I just want to say Richard is wrong about that. But suppose I am wrong. Suppose Richard's right and there, it is fundamentally incomplete. What we could ask is, even if we did have good reason for thinking that our science is incomplete or just straightforwardly wrong, it seems to me that bringing in a God of the gaps... That's not going to help. It's not going to amount to an explanation. All that you really do when you come into a gap in the scientific explanation and you want to fill it and you say, well, God did it or an intelligent designer did it or something, really what you're doing is just inserting the claim, something that we don't understand explains this in a way that we don't understand, right? I mean, to insert a God into the gap doesn't really provide the kind of explanation that we're looking for, I would argue. And it would be simpler to just say, we don't understand, right? Here's an outstanding scientific problem. This seems to be a hole. This seems to be a gap. We don't have any way of filling it right now, so just leave it as a question mark and see what we can do with it as time moves on. And indeed, in the history of science, you see this happening fairly often, that there's often gaps in explanation, and these get filled in with what come to be regarded as perfectly natural entities. So, for example, when Isaac Newton supposed that there's a force of gravity, people immediately asked, well, how does gravity work? How is it that two bodies across the universe from one another can exert forces upon one another? And Newton's famous answer was, I frame no hypothesis, meaning I have no idea, right? But this is what happens. And eventually, I mean, gravity just became understood as a natural force. Same with magnetism, although I don't know that anybody brought in God to explain magnetism. I'd be sort of surprised if no one did. And then it took somebody like Michael Faraday to think of lines of force and a magnetic field to explain the phenomena of magnetism in a natural way. Biological functions the same way. The idea of an organism being alive, here I'm not talking about origins of life, but just the property of being alive, was thought to require some sort of miraculous explanation. But through 19th century biology, they came to understand how something can be alive without supposing that there's any sort of divine juice being given, right, at each moment to make the thing continue to live. Okay. So let me turn then to scientific naturalism, supposing that I've made good on these arguments, which I would admit I've really just only gestured toward. Okay. What is scientific naturalism? Look at this happy scientist, right? And the happy view that he presents. Scientific naturalism we can think of as a cluster of ideas. First of all of nature plays by the same rules, right? That there are laws of nature that bind everything, no exceptions. And second of all, that the scientific method, again, this is a very general kind of way of stating this, as if there is a single scientific method, but at least an important scientific method, will reveal those laws and forces. And so by scientific method, I mean putting out some sort of hypothesis, figuring out how you would test for it, testing for it, and then revising it if you need to, or just holding on to it tentatively if no revision seemed to be required. And that's the way to discover those laws and forces. And finally, that the seeming violations of those laws, that whenever it seems like a miracle is happening or the laws are being violated, those can usually be explained through complications or what is below the screen here, through psychology, right? And you can think of certain cases where it looks like something miraculous is happening, but on a deeper investigation of everything that's operating at the time, you find out that it can be explained, it just requires a more complex story. So, for example, there are cases where physicists think they've detected transmissions that are happening faster than the speed of light, but you work at it, and you realize there's something you're not taking into account, there's some complicating factor, and then you find out no law has actually been violated, it's just a complex situation. Or in the more common cases, when people report having seen a miracle, having seen the laws of nature violated, that can often be explained through psychology, right? Because people are often drawn towards believing all sorts of miraculous, wonderful things that never really happen. Okay. So generally, the way that the naturalist accounts some of the core phenomena of religion is in the following. A naturalist would say, for every supernatural explanation, right, every explanation that has as a critical appeal, God did it, right, there is a natural one that we can discover. And second of all, it's rational to prefer natural explanations to supernatural ones. Right? So take, for example, a case in which recently, I saw a video done by the skeptic Michael Shermer, in which he looked at all of the people who have seen the face of the Virgin Mary on the side of this building, right? And so you go down to this building, it's in Texas, I think, someplace like this, and it's a mirrored building, and if you look, sure enough, you see this kind of figure that looks like a woman with a hood, right? And so people are camped out there, and they're writing down their wishes and prayers and scraps of paper and putting it down in front of this image on the side of this building. But then the Shermer skeptic guy and a couple others walk around the building, and they see that the Virgin Mary miraculous appears wherever there's a sprinkler head and a palm tree, right? And so there, we don't really need the supernatural explanation of the Virgin making herself visible, right? It could just be a sprinkler head. Coupled together with people's desire, of course, to see miraculous, wonderful things. And so we can always ask ourselves whenever we see some sort of apparently supernatural phenomenon, which is more likely? That magic happens, right? That it really is a genuinely supernatural phenomenon, or that somehow we are ignorant or deceived, right? We don't know all of the natural forces that are at play, or we're being deceived because we're not getting, of course, all of the information that we would need to really see what's going on. And this can happen, of course, in cases where people report to us a miracle, right? We can always ask Hume's famous question, right? Which is more miraculous, right? That this person got something wrong, or that the miracle that they describe really happened? And usually it's less of a miracle that somebody got something wrong, and it seems to be rational to always believe in the lesser miracle. Okay, so if it's rational to prefer natural explanations to supernatural ones, then it seems supernatural explanations shouldn't be accepted so long as there's always a natural explanation in the offering. And so when we turn to the core doctrines, or what I'm calling the core doctrines of ancient religion, there are, I would say, natural explanations that ought to be preferred to the supernatural ones. So, for example, with the religious concept of creation, and here I've got to kind of narrow the focus a bit. I mean, there's so many different religious accounts of creation. I'm going to take a sort of generic, I suppose, Christian-like view of creation. The natural replacement for that view of creation would be some doctrine about the Big Bang, coupled with Darwinian evolution, applied to living forms, but also possibly to non-living processes, and together with quantum mechanics, that those things packaged together can give us an account of where the universe came from. And that's more natural than believing that some supernatural entity somehow created the world ex nihilo, or created the world through some kind of supernatural force of organizing the matter so that it runs the way that it's supposed to run. The religious concept of the soul can be replaced by what we're discovering through cognitive science and through neuroscience, that there are many, many amazing things the human mind does, but these are tractable problems, meaning that scientists can figure out how the brain actually processes the information and gets the job done. No appeal to immaterial entities is required. I don't know that there is a natural replacement for this third religious concept of providence, right? This guarantee that God is concerned for us, that things will work out. I think that the scientific naturalist would simply say, no, no such guarantee. Right? And that's the scariest, I would say, the scariest thing about scientific naturalism. There's no possibility for providence. There's no reason for thinking that there's anything out there in the universe that really cares about us or has any direction meant for us. Okay. I've probably alienated just about everybody in the room. But go with me for a moment. We can, when we get to discussion, we can come back to all of these objections I've just sort of launched. Suppose that there is this kind of collision between scientific naturalism, as I've explained it, and the core doctrines in religion, right? If there is this kind of collision and you want to hold on to your scientific naturalism, well, then what do you do? And here I want to say there are really two choices available to us. There's the Spinoza route and there's the Nietzsche route. Okay. So first of all, the Spinoza response to this collision between what natural science seems to tell us about the world and what religion tells us about the world. Well, Spinoza's response, Spinoza lived back in the 17th century, and so he certainly wasn't acquainted with Big Bang theories and cognitive science and all of these other fancy things, but he saw the collision happening. He saw that the modern scientific worldview just didn't leave room for the God of Abraham. So he wrote a work in 1670 called The Theological Political Treatise, in which he argued that the Bible, when you just pick it up as a historical document, is filled with all sorts of errors and superstition, right? The authors of the Bible, or the characters in the Bible, often describe nature incorrectly. So accounts of miracles, which Spinoza is sure can't happen, given science, have to be wrong. That the principles of nature that get described by the authors of Scripture are systematically wrong. It's the same as if you picked up Homer's Iliad or Homer's Odyssey, and if you took that as a guide for science, for how the world really works, you'd be in really sorry shape, right? I mean, you'd end up believing that Zeus comes down from time to time and Ares comes down and swings a battle axe. You'd believe all of these demonstrably ridiculous things. And Spinoza picks up the Bible in sort of the same attitude, the same sort of perspective, and says, it's not really any better than the Odyssey or the Iliad in terms of getting the truth right. Nevertheless, said Spinoza, the Bible does contain many worthy principles and a lot of wisdom. Meaning, if Spinoza's a bit of an elitist, so I'll put this in kind of an elitist way. If you can't handle science and you can't handle philosophy, well, at least you can pick up the Bible and get a nice code of living. It gets you to lead a life that is rewarding and rich and meaningful. So there's something to it. There's some disagreement here. But there's something really admirable about it, even if it gets sort of everything wrong. And I'll talk about that in a minute. And so he would say the Bible should be read as a guide to life, not as some kind of guide towards metaphysical or scientific truth. The authors of Scripture just didn't have the competence to get the metaphysics right or to get the science right, although they did, for all that, manage to write a really good tome of advice. Okay, so if you wanted to follow Spinoza's route, you might end up with a picture of religion as follows. If you're following Spinoza, you would accept religion as a powerful and transformative myth, right? Just like the ancient Greek myths or many other stories about the divine aspect of the world that we would identify as myths. Meaning it's not literally true, but it's an inspirational way of interpreting experience. Right? And somebody could, I suppose, I've never met anyone who's done this, but somebody could pick up Homer's Odyssey in the same way and say, well, of course I don't believe, I don't even know whether Odysseus existed, right? Let alone the Cyclops and Calypso and all of these other characters. But I can get a kind of philosophy of life out of this book. I can live in the Odysseus kind of way. And perhaps you could imagine a reading group that kind of gets out of control and they start meeting weekly and affirming the Odysseus kinds of truths and they go on to lead these heroic, majestic lives while all the time being conscious that they're basing it in a work of fiction. There's a kind of truth in it that gets beyond the facts, and that I think is another important component of this interpretation, to divorce truth, meaning the significant kind of ways of interpreting experience, divorcing truth from mere facts. And there's a sense in which many mythologies get all of the facts wrong, in a certain sense, about the creation of the world, about the soul, about providence and all. They get all the facts wrong, but they manage to capture a kind of truth, okay? Meaning, they have a way of organizing our experiences and organizing our attitudes so that we end up living pretty enjoyable lives and good lives. Okay. Now, there might be a way to build a kind of metaphysics that actually accounts for this. And the theologian that at least I'm familiar with who has done this is Rudolf Bultmann, who lived throughout most of the 20th century. where Bultmann was bold enough to claim that maybe all of the facts about the story of Jesus are completely wrong. They could even be fictional. It doesn't really matter. The point is that the kind of life that you get out of it is worth living. There's a joke I heard about Bultmann that kind of captures this idea, where supposedly people are digging in the Middle East and they discover the tomb of Jesus and there's a body in it. Oops, right? And so everybody's worried, and they call the Pope and they say, "What should we do?" And the Pope says, "Oh man, I don't know." So he calls Rudy Bultmann and says, "What should we do, Bultmann? We found the tomb and there's a body in it. I mean, he's in it." And Bultmann says, "Huh. So he really did exist." Right? So, I mean, Bultmann kind of puts together this theology that is not grounded in any kind of historical fact, right? It's more than that, he would say. It's grounded in a metaphysical truth, right? That even if you find out Jesus never existed, it doesn't matter, right? You would still read, you know, say that Corinthians chapter on love is being extraordinarily powerful, even if it turns out that that the other facts of the Jesus story were wrong. Okay. But following this route, there's no going back on the mythological status, right? I mean, this means that the story of creation, the story of the soul, the afterlife, heaven, hell, final justice being done, divine providence, all of that is fictional, right? And it might have the power to shape our lives, but it doesn't have any sort of predictive power. Now, is this a genuinely livable kind of marriage between religion and science? I mean, this might sound good to say in the abstract, but can you actually walk? You can talk the talk, but can you actually walk this walk, right? Can you actually have the kind of confidence in these religious claims if you're at the same time admitting that these claims are kind of coming from works of fiction in a way, right? I mean, this is why it's maybe hard to imagine the Odysseus book group that gets out of hand, right? Because, I mean, imagine a group of Harry Potter fanatics that cultivate some kind of way of living out of the books of Harry Potter. You kind of hope that they continue to recognize these are works of fiction, right? And they don't go over the line and start to believe in the actual existence of whoever these people are, Gandalf or something, I have no idea, right? Well, I think it might be livable, and one possibility that I would want to pursue on this is looking at Walt Whitman, of all people, our homegrown poet, where when you read Leaves of Grass and you read The Song of Myself in particular, there's a kind of reverence that Whitman has for human experience, for the great wealth of nature, for love, for other people, for experience, that never really goes into a kind of metaphysical doctrine about souls and creation and providence. It's very much a this worldly celebration of experience and human life. And not, of course, wholly positive. There's a lot of descriptions in Whitman's poetry of the really ghastly hospitals during the Civil War and death and disease and corruption and so on. Whitman accepts that too, but finds a kind of reverence in the natural world that doesn't require any kind of supernatural forces. Whether that amounts to a religion or not, I don't know. I mean, this is religion shorn of the soul, shorn of creation, shorn of divine providence. And you might say, well, that's a nice, lovely, poetic way of looking at human experience, but that ain't no religion. But it seems to me that's kind of, if you take scientific materialism or scientific naturalism, if you take it seriously, that's sort of the closest you can get. That's the closest approximation you can get to anything that's religious. Okay. Well, that's one response. That's the way of Spinoza. The other response is the way of Nietzsche. And if you didn't like that, you certainly won't like this. All right. Nietzsche's, of course, famous quote is, "God is dead." And that's followed on innumerable bathroom walls by the claim that Nietzsche is dead, right, signed by God. But when Nietzsche claims that God is dead, right, it's mostly just really high-octane prose that he's using, but partly he's getting at the idea that the idea is dead, that we don't need God anymore. We're at an age where the notion of God is something we've outgrown. that it's dead for us, that there's no use to it, that it doesn't do anything except sort of shelter us in ways that we ought not be sheltered. And his claim is that it's up to individuals to create meaning in their lives and not to take it from other sources, right, such as the Bible or institutions such as the church. And indeed, in Nietzsche's view of life, there's nothing that is intrinsically worthy of reverence. And this is what makes his Overman, his Übermensch, so scary. He steps beyond good and evil. He steps beyond the things that we revere and the things that we loathe. And this Overman, in this creative act, creates his own values. He creates his own things that he prizes, and it's utterly up to him to do so. That's why before the talk proceeded, we were talking about this metaphor that Nietzsche gives of the three stages of man, where first you're a camel who carries the burden of tradition upon you, and then you're a lion who destroys those traditions, who kind of sees through them and deconstructs them. And then you become the third thing, a child of all things, a baby, a creative thing, right? A new creation. And it's up to you to make this kind of new creation. And the only thing, indeed, that can kind of redeem the world, according to Nietzsche, is the world itself. And this is where I would argue his doctrine of the eternal recurrence comes in. Nietzsche looks at all the different religions and says they all find some way of denying the value of this world intrinsically, meaning the world itself is suffering, says the Buddhist, right? Or the world itself is something that you eventually get over, according to the Christian, right? You find a way to transcend it. You find a way to surmount it. It's excused by an afterlife with a heaven and a hell where perfect justice is served. So that the natural world is something that is only valuable to the extent that it plays some role in a bigger, larger, supernatural cosmic scheme. So Nietzsche said the only way to kind of redeem this world without going through the error of religion, Gesundheit, is to accept the eternal recurrence, which is this outlandish view in a way, that the world will repeat itself endlessly without any change whatsoever. If you've seen the movie Groundhog Day, right? This is Groundhog Day inflated to cosmic proportions, where you get the same universe again and again and again. The difference in Groundhog Day is that Bill Murray gets to live the same day again and again and again, but he gets better at it. Not so in Nietzsche's view. There's no change at all, right? You live exactly the same life as you've always lived, again and again and again. And his thinking is, if you can get yourself to accept that fact, if you can embrace it, which he found horrifying, right? Because he had a really miserable life. He had migraines, he had vomiting, he had phlegm, he eventually went insane. It was a miserable life. So this was a real challenge he set for himself. If I can get myself to say, I welcome this life again and again and again without a single change, then, he says, you've found value in the life. Then you've not redeemed it by something outside of life. You've embraced it as it really is for what it is, right? Without making some kind of dodge, reaching into the supernatural to kind of pay back the loan, I suppose, you might say. Okay, so only eternal recurrence redeems the world. Well, this all sounds quite jolly, perhaps, or scary and jolly in the same sort of maniacal way that all of Nietzsche's writings seem scary and jolly. It really is troubling. And I think it's troubling foremost on the aspect of morality. The nice part about the old views of religion is that there's a kind of order to things, there's a rightness, there's expectations, there's doctrines about what makes a life valuable that hopefully reaches beyond into something that can't be changed, something that is necessary, something that is beyond any kind of corruption or question or challenge. But you don't get that with Nietzsche's view. Indeed, you get this natural account of morality, that the moral beliefs that we have, if they're rooted in sympathetic feelings that we have towards one another, that our sympathies result from generations of natural selection, so that in some kind of rough cartoon, you might say that our ancestors who didn't really care about one another all died off for perhaps obvious reasons. And so the populations that survived were the people who actually showed some sort of concern for one another. And that's why we all have at least some modicum of sympathy for one another, because it's just our evolutionary heritage, right? But that would also mean that if those conditions were different, right, then natural selection would work differently and our sympathies would be different. If the world favored, in a certain sense, groups that that routinely cheated one another, then we wouldn't have as much sympathy for one another. So the sympathy that we feel, the fellow feeling, the pity sometimes, and just the concern that we have for other human beings, is something that's rooted in a long chain of historical accidents. And there aren't any higher stories to be told. We end up caring for one another in just the way that orangutans care for one another. And if you put orangutans in a really awful, difficult situation in which they weren't rewarded for caring for one another, then over a series of generations, they wouldn't care for one another, right? And that would just be a change in natural fact. Nothing more to it than that. And that's an awful, scary, cold, disappointing view. In the end, we could say, what do we say to this overman who has stepped beyond good and evil and who has decided that a life of incredible, outrageous violence is the good life? All that we could say is, gee, my sympathy doesn't go that way, right? Or you seem to be from an aberrant pool of ancestors or something like that. My, what a strange genetic code you're following. I don't know that we'd have anything very compelling to say to an overman other than you certainly are different. So I'm not sure that the Nietzsche kind of denial of religion really has enough substance there to give us what we want out of morality, although you can readily anticipate Nietzsche's response. Tough. Grow up. That's the world we're in. Look around, indeed. Okay, so the conclusion from all of these ruminations is this, that scientific naturalism precludes the miraculous objects of belief of ancient religions. All the miraculous stuff that ancient religion believes in is stuff that just gets ruled out by scientific naturalism. It's no longer possible to believe in that stuff anymore. So, two options are available. We can follow Spinoza and we can invest the natural world with a quasi-religious significance, right? This kind of Whitman-esque wonder at our experience. And we can see a kind of divinity at work. Spinoza himself, of course, did this in his own Metaphysics. He's famous for having claimed there's one substance in existence, and that is God, meaning you and everything you ever encounter is somehow an expression of God. So Spinoza was willing to see the natural world as thoroughly divine, right? And although it's not probably accurate to say he revered it or he regarded it with religious awe, there's certainly something divine in his worldview that is palpable. Okay, so that would be one route, is follow the ways of scientific naturalism, but sort of soak in some religious significance to it all. And the other route is to follow Spinoza's route and simply abandon religion altogether and then face the consequences. See what you can do in terms of naturalizing morality. And if you can't do as well as you hope, well, change your hopes. Okay, with that I'll conclude and I'll face my own consequences. Thank you for your attention.